Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
Hi, I'm Hannah, and I'm very excited to be hosting What in the World, a new daily podcast from the BBC World Service, where we try to help you make sense of the world around you, of the big things that are happening, the small things that are happening, and everything in between. Search for What in the World wherever you get your BBC podcasts and hit subscribe.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Nick Miles, and at 13 hours GMT on Friday the 18th of August, these are our main stories. The BBC has been told that 1,400 people have starved to death in Ethiopia's northern region of Tigray since international food aid was suspended in April. Russia has accused Ukraine of launching a drone attack on Moscow's business district. The growing power of China is expected to occupy the leaders of the United States, Japan and South Korea at a summit later today. Also in this podcast...
I don't think I've had a second yet to think about the potential consequences here, because if things don't turn for the better, I might lose my house in a couple of days' time, but I haven't really had a chance to stop and think about that.
People are evacuating the Canadian city of Yellowknife as wildfires close in, but some are yet to do so. And as we record this podcast, the deadline is less than 5 hours away. There was huge relief last year when the Ethiopian government and rebel fighters from the northern region of Tigray signed a peace deal. Thousands of people were killed and many more displaced during 2 years of fighting. Normally, the end of a conflict brings humanitarian relief, but now the BBC has been told that at least 1,400 Tigrayans have died from starvation in recent months because of a lack of food, although a senior official says the number of dead could be much higher. I spoke to our correspondent in the region, Mercy Juma.
The situation in Tigray right now is difficult. I think that's the best word to describe it, because we have spoken to people and also just seen what's happening in Tigray of people going for days without food. They are not getting what can sustain them, and especially people who are in refugee camps, but who are being displaced by the 2 years of war, that they cannot even sustain themselves within the camps, that they have to go out and beg in the local markets for them to be able to feed themselves and their children. And what led to this is because after the 2 year war, we had the WFP and USAID coming in and just rallying to assist about 6 million Tigrayans, to give them food aid and help them come back to their feet. But now they announced a pause in food aid about 3 months ago. And this is after they discovered that their donations were being stolen and diverted, and a lot of people are being allegedly implicated in this Tigray food aid scandal. So right now, people are struggling to get by, and the local officials there are quoting more than about 1,400 people dying in just about three regions. And this number does not include other regions that have not been tallied. And as much as BBC cannot independently verify this 1,400 figure, we can see the impact of what's happening in Tigray.
Mercy, many, many people are suffering because a few people allegedly stole this food supplies. When is this pause in the food aid going to end?
So, first of all, the pause happened 3 months ago, and we have been speaking to WFP, and what they are saying is that they are making plans to resume. They don't know when they will be resuming, but they want to resume at a point where they are fully confident that their systems will be able to be, you know, foolproof, and that the food and donation that they are giving will be able to reach the intended recipients. So we don't know really when that will happen.
That was Mercy Juma. On the battlefield, air support is seen as critical to troops on the ground. And that's why ever since Russia invaded Ukraine last year, President Zelensky has been urging the West to provide his country with fighter jets. Well, now the transfer of F-16 jets could soon happen. The US has said they'll move quickly to approve the transfer of the fighter jets when Ukrainian pilots are ready to fly them. And that training program was agreed back in May. Yuri Sak, an advisor to Ukraine's Minister of Defence, gave his reaction to the BBC.
This is a very significant reassurance. Acquiring fourth generation aircraft, acquiring F-16s, will make our skies more secure, and essentially it will bring our victory closer.
Earlier, I asked our correspondent James Waterhouse, who's in Kyiv, if we know when Ukraine will get these jets.
Well, if you ask Kyiv, not this year. I think the downbeat assessment we had this week was that they weren't expecting to get them as early as the autumn or winter, reason being that even with this US green light, which, let's be frank, these F-16s will not arrive without the US's say-so, nevertheless, you have that pilot training program going on involving 11 countries. Those aircraft and all of the hardware needed, all of that support equipment and support staff will have to make their way over to Ukraine, and that equates to a time delay of several months. That is clear, and that has long been the frustration to Ukraine. Why? Well, as you said, it is Russia enjoying air superiority, not in the traditional sense where we see Russian jets roaming Ukrainian airspace, but there are more of them in the skies around occupied territories or inside Russia itself, where they are launching relentless missile attacks on Ukraine, as well as making incursions on the front line. And this is why it loops back to President Zelensky's repeated claim. It's not been a subtle messaging campaign, has it? Where he said, we need fighter jets and we need them yesterday to unlock that.
And I suppose analysts there are thinking it could be a game changer, but it depends on the numbers, I suppose.
It does depend on numbers. I mean, if we take the Netherlands, for example, one of the countries that has been given the green light to provide these F-16 fighter jets after training, it's about the models they have that are scheduled to be taken out of service. So with the Netherlands, we're talking about a couple of dozen, roughly. So if you have 11 Western allies which form part of this green light from the US, then that could add up quite significantly. But they do need to arrive. Pilots do need to be competent in them. They rely on completely different systems to the Soviet-era MiGs that are used in Ukraine. And it also depends on Russian air defences. But there is a concern that hasn't gone away here. The West has always been worried about an escalation with Russia, yet their confidence has grown and we've seen an increase in military aid. But that concern is especially prevalent when we're talking about fighter jets, because take this scenario. Say you have an American-made fighter jet flying in Ukrainian-occupied airspace and it's engaged with an air defence system and it targets that air defence system, which is on Russian territory. You then have a much more sizable Western intervention than you could argue with, say, an armoured vehicle being driven over the front line. So there are those nerves, but there is clearly a direction of travel that Ukraine will welcome despite its frustrations.
That was James Waterhouse. Well, as Ukraine waits for the fighter jets to arrive, Russia's defence ministry says its anti-aircraft systems have shot down a drone over the capital, Moscow. Defence officials say Ukraine is responsible. Air traffic at Moscow's airports was also disrupted. More details from our correspondent, Will Vernon, in Moscow.
The authorities say air defence systems shot down a drone in the west of the city centre overnight. The statement claimed Ukraine was responsible. Video posted on social media shows an explosion near the Moscow City Business District, an area that's been attacked before. Today, a major exhibition centre was damaged, although it's not clear whether this was caused by falling debris or whether the drone hit its target. Drone attacks in areas around Moscow are common. This incident took place just 5 kilometres from the Kremlin.
That was Will Vernon. Back in May, the World Health Organization declared an end to COVID-19 as a global health emergency, but it did emphasize that coronavirus was still a threat. Now, the WHO has just announced that it's closely monitoring a new variant, which has been detected in Israel, Denmark, and the United States. Imogen Folkes in Geneva, where the WHO is based, tell me what we know.
Not as much as the WHO would clearly like to know. What it's been called is BA2.86. Now, it could be a distant relative descendant of Omicron, but what is worrying the WHO and why they've classified it as a variant under monitoring is because it shows quite a lot of mutations. Some variants only show a couple. They're almost identical to their parent, if you like. This one not. And the more mutations a new variant shows, the more likely the way it affects a human being could change, the more likely, crucially, it could evade existing vaccines. Early days, though, not much sequencing going on, and that's part of the problem. So close analysis before we know exactly what we're dealing with this variant.
So prudent to be cautious at the moment about this particular variant. What about the way countries are testing? A lot of them have stopped testing for coronavirus, haven't they? But what do we know about the impact or spread of the disease globally now?
Well, we know that people are still dying and there are still many, many, many cases. Unfortunately, some of the countries best resourced to carry on with testing, tracing and sequencing, and this is where you spot a new variant, have relaxed those systems. And I think here in Geneva, there's a certain amount of frustration at WHO headquarters because it's this kind of taking your eye off the ball which could allow not just COVID, but a new infectious disease to emerge, which could send us back to, well, hopefully not, but could send us back to all the rigors of 2020 and lockdowns. So the WHO really would like countries to focus hard on testing people and analysing new strains so that we know what we're dealing with. And also, in case we need a new vaccine for COVID, drug companies need to know what the new variant looks like exactly to make the vaccine as effective as possible.
Imogen Folks. Camp David, the country retreat of US presidents, has a long track record of being the setting for historic foreign policy agreements. And later, for the first time, President Biden is hosting both the Japanese and the South Korean presidents there. So what's brought these three leaders together? I spoke to our Asia-Pacific editor, Michael Bristow.
This is actually a major diplomatic event. United States, South Korea, Japan, already allies. But essentially what is going to happen later today is they're going to deepen that alliance, agree to share more information on security, that kind of thing. A major moment, really, in the diplomatic history of these countries. Brought about partly because President Biden has re-engaged America with its traditional allies after President Trump, but mostly because the leaders of both South Korea and Japan have decided to put the antagonism over Japan's wartime aggression in Korea behind them and look to the future. And particularly ahead, they see the growing power of China in East Asia and they want to come together to try and essentially do something about that. They know that on their own, they don't really stand a chance against China. So they're re-engaging with each other and re-energising their alliance.
I mean, it's quite predictable, but what are China's views on this?
Well, already they've shown their opposition, their annoyance to this kind of alliance. A foreign ministry spokesman today said, really, the Asia-Pacific region shouldn't be a wrestling ground for geopolitical rivalry. Essentially, China, from all it's said and done over recent years, sees itself as a growing power in the region, the United States as the waning power, and doesn't want something like this where countries coming together to form an alliance against themselves. And over recent weeks, they've become actually the Chinese quite desperate in trying to persuade South Korea and Japan not to engage with America in this way. This is what the foreign minister Wang Yi said at a conference quite recently.
Americans see all visitors from China, South Korea and Japan as Asians. They can't tell the difference. No matter how yellow you dye your hair or how sharp you make your nose, you'll never turn into a Westerner. You have to know your roots.
Really quite strident comment there by the Chinese foreign ministry, and there were, understandably, some accusations of racism. But on the diplomatic front, I think it's quite telling, actually, that it suggests to me that China's losing the argument. If you have to appeal on racial grounds for countries to support you, then essentially you're not doing a very good job at persuading you to support them because of the arguments.
That was Michael Bristow. A woman in South Africa who made headlines when she was jailed for kidnapping a baby, Zephanie Nurse, and raising her as her own, will be released on parole and placed under correctional supervision for 3 years. In 1997, Lavona Solomon abducted Zephanie from a hospital in Cape Town when she was just 2 days old, taking her from her sleeping mother's bedside. Well, the crime came to light in 2016 when Zephanie unknowingly made friends with her biological sister after their friends noticed the striking resemblance the girls decided to take a DNA test, which led to Solomon's arrest and imprisonment. She served 7 years of her 10-year sentence. My colleague James Copnell spoke to our correspondent in Johannesburg, Nomsa Maseka.
The nurse family, they have always celebrated Zephanie's birthday to commemorate it. And when they did find out that she's still out there and she's alive and she lived just a few kilometers from their home, that was something else for them. And that is why it's still making headlines here in South Africa, with people beginning to ask questions about how many more children are out there and not too far from their families where they were stolen from.
So it is possible that there are other cases like this that haven't been in the news.
Absolutely, particularly in the early 1990s, when security was not as tight in hospital maternity wards, particularly where anyone who claims to be family was allowed to walk in and visit a mom and a baby. And what are the chances? Most mothers at that time, after they have given birth, of course, they're exhausted, they're sleeping, and the baby disappears.
What happened, do we know, to Zephanie Nurse in the subsequent years?
Well, Zephanie continued to live with Lavona Solomon's husband because he raised her as his own, even during the trial. It was very difficult for her to come to terms with the fact that the two people that raised her were actually not her biological parents, but they raised her as such. But when the truth was revealed, she has tried to build somewhat of a relationship with her biological parents, and she has in the past said that relationship is going well. But she's also spoken about Lavona Solomon, the woman who raised her as her own, and said that she's very happy that Lavona is finally going to be released from prison, and that she hopes that she will be rehabilitated so that she's able to move on with her life.
Does the fact that Lavona Solomon is going to get out on parole, does that suggest that she has expressed remorse for what she did?
You know, from the beginning of the trial, you know, there were several lies that she told during the trial, where she says she was also a victim of the circumstances because she claimed that she was given this baby at a train station and not that she actually went in and stole the baby herself. But the judge at the time said, you knew that this child was not yours. You had so many opportunities to take her to authorities and report this child as you found her, as you claim. However, you continued raising her. So where's the remorse? And also the fact that she pleaded not guilty to the charge also made the nurse family and, of course, the judge believe that she did not show any remorse.
Nomsa Maseko in Johannesburg, speaking to my colleague James Copnell. Still to come,
Parmesan is one of the most counterfeited cheeses, and it's estimated that these knockoffs made $2 billion in the last year alone.
So could microchips stop the production of counterfeit cheeses?
Wow, what an experience to be a part of the Tokyo Olympics.
It's so etched in my memory.
It's one of the pinnacles of my athletic career.
On the Podium is the podcast where Olympic and Paralympic athletes share their remarkable stories. From the struggles,
lots of sacrifices, lots of hard work, tears, a lot of things that the outside world doesn't know.
To the victories.
In the water, I could do anything that anybody else could do.
On the Podium from the BBC World Service. Find it wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Welcome back to the Global News Podcast. Evacuating an entire city is a huge logistical challenge. The authorities in Yellowknife in Canada's far north have the added problem of a raging wildfire bearing down on them. There are just two options. You can either fly out, if you can get a flight, or there's just one road out with safe evacuation centres hundreds of kilometres away. They've set a deadline of noon local time for the 20,000 residents to get out, and that's just 4 hours away or so as we record this. Whilst most residents are now fleeing their homes to nearby towns, Dr. Michelle Toomer from an organisation called Veterinarians Without Borders is still in Yellowknife for the moment.
In Yellowknife, we're the capital city of Northwest Territories. We have a population of about 22,000 people. And in our city, there's only 4 veterinarians. I'm one of them. We have been working for the last few weeks on evacuation responses for animals in other nearby communities in the Northwest Territories that have also been devastated with wildfires. And now my hometown of Yellowknife needs support. And it was just a no-brainer that I needed to stay and help have people safely evacuate with their pets, but then also help to take care of any pets that had to be left behind.
What about those who've already left? Ollie Williams is a journalist from Yellowknife who evacuated the city on Wednesday and is now in Fort Simpson.
People have been leaving since yesterday evening. Some people left even before the evacuation order was declared. They saw the writing on the wall. They realized that this looked like a relatively bleak situation, and they got themselves on the road. I was one of those, to be frank with you. About 12, 13 hours before the evacuation order was declared, I left the city because I think some of us had concluded that this situation was starting to look beyond the control of the authorities. And that, of course, has now proved to be the case. And about 20,000 people are being told they've got to get out of the city and get south to safety. There is only one road south, and it's not a very big road either. It's one lane in each direction. So thousands of people have got to fit down that road. There is one petrol station worth talking about between Yellowknife and Alberta, the province to the south, which represents safety. People have been getting in their cars. They've been packing up. And I'll be honest with you, they've been in relatively good and ordered spirits about it so far, and I'm touching wood here, I'm fingers crossed and I hope for the best. So far, this evacuation has proceeded by road, I think, about as well as it could have done. As I say, there's one petrol station there. It hasn't run out of fuel. They've kept refueling that again and again and again. There are lineups kilometers long to get through that because it's such a long drive, but it's going okay. There haven't been any major accidents, as you can imagine. All it would take is one. The road would be closed. I don't know what we'd do then. So far, so good on that front. The airlift is a different story. They didn't get the airlift going in time this morning because of weather issues, so they didn't get as many flights out the door as they wanted to. Now they've got to make up for that tomorrow. They didn't get a flight out from the hospital today to get all the patients out safely the way they hope. Now they've got to get that done tomorrow. The clock's ticking. I don't think I've had a second yet to think about the potential consequences here, because if things don't turn for the better, I might lose my house in a couple of days' time, but I haven't really had a chance to stop and think about that. There has never been an evacuation on this scale in the Northwest Territories. Very, very rarely has there been an evacuation on this scale in Canada. We are facing a critical 24 to 48 hours. Absolutely, we are.
Ollie Williams. Well, as the wildfires in Canada rage on, across the Pacific to the west on the Hawaiian island of Maui, the devastation caused by the wildfires there is starting to have more widespread ramifications. The head of the Emergency Management Agency for the island has resigned following criticism that the agency did not sound sirens during the wildfires last week, which have left 111 people dead and 1,000 missing. Herman Andaya defended the decision not to use the sirens because of their usual use to warn of incoming tsunamis, and that may have caused people to run towards the fires. Our North America correspondent Sophie Long sent this update from the island.
On Wednesday, the head of Maui's Emergency Management Agency defended the decision not to sound those sirens. He said that people could have gone mauka. Now, mauka is a Hawaiian directional term. It means into the mountains or inland. He was implying that people may have been panicked and gone in the wrong direction. Well, you'll find very few people here in Maui who will agree with that. And today, Thursday, it's still Thursday here in Maui, the same man, Herman Andaya, resigned. Now, the only reason he gave for that resignation were unspecified health reasons, but of course it comes just 24 hours after he defended that decision not to sound the sirens. And this comes while the search and recovery effort is still ongoing. The search and recovery teams have now recovered 111 bodies. Only six of those have been identified. So it's still in its early phases, really. A mobile morgue has arrived in Maui with extra coroners to help with the painstaking task of identifying those who lost their lives.
Sophie Long. Ecuador was once widely regarded as a safe, friendly travel destination, a stable nation with a functioning political system. Now it has become the most murderous in South America. Ecuadorians go to the polls this weekend in the first round of presidential elections. Well, last week, a candidate was shot dead, which sent shockwaves through a nation that was once peaceful, but in the past few years has seen a huge rise in violence because of drug trafficking and organised crime. Our South America correspondent, Katie Watson, sent this report from Guayaquil.
out on patrol in Ecuador's biggest city. Guayaquil is home to the country's largest port. It's a key part of the lucrative drugs routes and now the epicentre of violent crime. Curfew's about to kick in Durán, an industrial part of the city overrun by traffickers. The police set up checkpoints, patting drivers down and using a flashlight to check for drugs and weapons inside vehicles. Some officers are so scared of reprisals by gangs, they cover their faces with black balaclavas. Captain Víctor Quespas Valencia is head of tonight's operation.
Gangs want to win territory. We're dealing with very violent deaths, people being found hanging from bridges or cut into pieces. International criminal organizations are recruiting people here, but they have lots of money. There's a total imbalance between organized crime and the police trying to stop it.
Mexican and Colombian cartels have infiltrated local gangs as they vie for domination of the cocaine trade. Ecuador was hit hard by COVID, and they've taken advantage of a country broken by a pandemic and by corrupt politics.
We just stopped and the police have got out and they're doing another operation, basically checking cars as they go along, and I've just been told that we're at an important area where on the one side there's a particular gang, the Latin Kings, and on the other side, gangs including Los Troneros, there are several, but basically this is a turf war along this road.
As the campaign draws to a close ahead of this weekend's elections, crime is top of the agenda. The words peace and security are repeated at candidate Daniel Noboa's closing campaign. Organisers know that will chime with Ecuadorians still in shock after Fernando Villavicencio's murder last week.
We live in an unsafe society. We have to do campaign even with our bulletproof vest. So that is, you know, a very negative sign. I think that we need to also work on the social side. And the problem is that by not giving people opportunities, we're feeding these organizations with young, new members.
But parading through drug trafficking territory carries big risks. Shortly after our interview, a nearby shootout brought a halt to the rally. The chaos filmed on social media. Daniel Noboa's team left sheltering in the campaign trap. These elections were called early after the current leader dissolved the National Assembly to avoid an impeachment vote. The chaotic politics in this country makes solving Ecuador's problems a challenge, but the crisis is one that goes far beyond Ecuador's control. As long as demand for cocaine keeps soaring, the cartels will fight for domination, and the body count will keep rising.
That was Katie Watson reporting from Ecuador. Seductress, vamp, a woman of easy virtue. They're uncomfortable words to say and offensive, obviously, to many people. And I've said them because they're all words that judges in India have been able to use up until now in their written judgments and in the courtroom. But this is all set to change as they've been handed a new guidebook which details a list of 40 words to avoid when describing women. I spoke to our correspondent, Divya Arya, in Delhi.
One would assume that they would not be part of ordinary life or especially judicial pronouncements, but they have been. In fact, I've reported extensively on judgments that stereotype women using such words. And this is exactly what the handbook is saying, that in some cases, stereotypes about women in terms of their character, in terms of how they should behave, especially in the context of sexual violence, in the context of domestic violence, those stereotypes are absorbed by judges and lawyers as much as by general society. And if we don't call them out, they either end up impacting outcomes, that is judgments, or even the way the judgments are pronounced by just reinforcing those stereotypes. So it has a glossary of 40 words, as you said. And just to give you a flavor, some of the recommendations in those words are like seductress, slut, whore, all of these words should just be replaced by women. Or Indian women, Western women should be replaced by women. Or women of loose morals, chaste women, career women should all be replaced by just woman, because these are all attributes that are being associated with them. Another thing that it suggests is things like ravished should just be replaced by assaulted, because it suggests a certain aspect of how assault happens from a perspective of a man in terms of enjoyment, not really violence, which is the prism from which it should be viewed. Similarly, the use of the term violated, which indicates that when a woman is raped, her honor is violated. She's demeaned in a certain way. And it says that violated should again be replaced by neutral terms like assaulted and raped.
That was Divya Arya in Delhi. Now, as a good meal often ends with a cheese course, so today's podcast ends with a cheese story. Parmesan is one of the world's most famous, but for it to be truly called Parmesan, it has to be made in Italy and under certain conditions. And now, cheesemakers in Italy are turning to the world of tech in order to protect their precious cheese brand. A new microchip is being trialled in the north of the country, all with the aim of stamping out a rise in fakes. The newsroom's Keris Maidment reports.
The process of making Parmesan cheese is a craft that dates back to the Middle Ages, and this technique has been protected ever since thanks to strict European guidelines. These state that a cheese can only be classed as true Parmigiano Reggiano if it is made in a specific region of northern Italy, it's matured for 12 months, and a team of experts have given their seal of approval. However, this system is being threatened by fakes, which have stormed the market. In fact, Parmesan is one of the most counterfeited cheeses, and it's estimated that these knockoffs made $2 billion in the last year alone, a figure that's not too far off the real version, which made just under $2.4 billion. So how can you make sure you're buying the real deal? Parmesan producers have turned to the world of tech and are testing a new microchip. The same size as a grain of salt, it's inserted into the waxy rind on the outside, and consumers will be able to scan and see exactly where their cheese has come from. Its placement on the wheel means it's unlikely to be eaten, but the chip is food safe and can sit in stomach acid for weeks without leaking any harmful substances. It's thought that these cheesy chips could pave the way for a whole new form of product verification, as the same technology could be used in livestock, car parts, and drug authentication. But for now, we'll have to wait and see how the 120,000 chipped Parmesan wheels fare in this trial and whether they'll be able to grate out the fraudsters.
That was Keris Maidment. And that's all from us for now. But before we go, here's Jackie with news of the next Happy Pod.
Yes, in this edition, the director determined to improve the representation of disabled people in film and TV. An invitation to brilliant people to join in a competition to bring light to places without reliable electricity. The Ukrainian soldier who became a ballet star after losing both legs in the war. The surfers rescued after 36 hours out at sea. And a story of community, art, and a really good dress. All in the Happy Pod, available from Saturday, August the 19th.
And if you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on Twitter, of course, at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Lewis Alsop, and the producer was Jack Graysmark. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Nick Miles, and until next time, goodbye. We'll be right back.